welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I've titled today's show, Beach Reads, The Second Wave. I hope you're lucky enough to be on vacation now or in the coming weeks. And whether it's in the mountains, at the beach, or across the pond, I'm here with suggested titles to take along. For my research, I've gone diving among several bestseller lists to bring you new top-of-mind titles. And my guests today, Jeffrey Deaver and Steve Barry, have bestsellers you'll find front and center on bookshops on every airport concourse. So, let's catch the wave and turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. An expansive family saga, both modern and mythic, Khaled Hosseini's highly anticipated novel, And the Mountains Echoed, begins in a small Afghan town in the 1950s. It follows one family through time and across the globe to France, California, and Greece. As the story begins, Abdullah, a 10-year-old boy, becomes the caretaker of his 3-year-old sister, Pari, and he does so with love, skill, and no hesitation or resentment. Their forced separation is the catalyst that creates the conflict and the momentum that propels the story beyond Afghanistan and into the larger world. Hosseini, author of the best-selling The Kite Runner and 1,000 Splendid Sons, explores the many ways in which families nurture, wound, betray, honor, and sacrifice for one another. The author shares the narration with Navid Negaban and Shora Agdashlu.
To his sons, he had taught already the value of honesty, courage, friendship, and hard work without complaint. They obeyed him, as good sons must, and helped their father with his crops. Though he loved all of his children, Baba Ayub privately had a unique fondness for one among them, his youngest, Qais, who was 3 years old. Qais was a little boy with dark blue eyes. He charmed anyone who met him with his devilish laughter. He was also one of those boys so bursting with energy that he drained others of theirs. When he learned to walk, he took such delight in it that he did it all day while he was awake, and then, troublingly, even at night in his sleep. He would sleepwalk out of the family's mud house and wander off into the moonlit darkness. Naturally, his parents worried. What if he fell into a well? Or got lost, or worst of all, was attacked by one of the creatures lurking the plains at night. They took stabs at many remedies, none of which worked. In the end, the solution Baba Ayub found was a simple one, as the best solutions often are. He removed a tiny bell from around the neck of one of his goats and hung it instead around Qais's neck. This way, the bell would wake someone if Qais were to rise in the middle of the night. The sleepwalking stopped after a time, but Qais grew attached to the bell and refused to part with it. And so, even though it didn't serve its original use, the bell remained fastened to the string around the boy's neck. When Baba Ayub came home after a long day's work, Qais would run from the house face first into his father's belly, the bell jingling with each of his tiny steps. Baba Ayub would lift him up and take him into the house, and Qais would watch with great attention as his father washed up, and then he would sit beside Baba Ayub at supper time. After they had eaten, Baba Ayub would sip his tea, watching his family, picturing a day when all of his children married and gave him children of their own, when he would be proud patriarch to an even greater brood. Alas, Abdullah and Pari, Baba Ayub's days of happiness came to an end. It happened one day that a div came to Maidan Sabz. As it approached the village from the direction of the mountains, the earth shook with each of its footfalls. The villagers dropped their shovels and hoes and axes and scattered. They locked themselves in their homes and huddled with one another. When the deafening sounds of the Dev's footsteps stopped, the skies over Maidan Sabz darkened with its shadow. It was said that curved horns sprouted from its head, and that coarse black hair covered its shoulders and powerful tail. They said its eyes shone red. No one knew for sure, you understand, at least no one living. The Div ate on the spot those who dared steal so much as a single glance. Knowing this, the villagers wisely kept their eyes glued to the ground. Everyone at the village knew why the Div had come. They had heard the tales of its visits to other villages, and they could only marvel at how Maidan Sabz had managed to escape its attention for so long. Perhaps, they reasoned, the poor, stringent lives that led in Maidan Sabz had worked in their favor, as their children weren't as well fed and didn't have as much meat on their bones. Even so, their luck had run out at last. Maidan Sabz trembled and held its breath. Families prayed that the Div would bypass their home, for they knew that if the Div tapped on their roof, they would have to give it one child. The Div would then toss the child into a sack, sling the sack over its shoulder, and go back the way it had come. No one would ever see the poor child again. And if a household refused, the Div would take all of its children. So where did the Div take the children to? To its fort, which sat atop a steep mountain. The Div's fort was very far from Maidan Sabz. Valleys, several deserts, and two mountain chains had to be cleared before you could reach it. And what sane person would, only to meet death?
We have just heard "And the Mountains Echoed" by Khaled Husseini. A former journalist, folk singer, and attorney, when Jeffrey Deaver writes a book, you can bet it'll be an international bestseller. The author of 31 novels, two collections of short stories, and a nonfiction law book, Deaver's received or been shortlisted for numerous awards in the States and around the world. He was selected to write Carte Blanche, the latest James Bond official continuation novel. For one of his recent novels, XO, a Catherine Dance thriller, Deaver wrote an album of country western songs. And yes, the rumors are true. He did appear as a corrupt reporter on his favorite soap opera, As the World Turns. Welcome, Jeff. It's great to have you back with us on The Book Report.
I know, it's good to be here again, Elaine.
All right. The Kill Room is the 10th book in your popular Lincoln Rhyme series. Since so many of your fans have seen the movie version of The Bone Collector with Denzel Washington and Angelina Jolie, how hard is it to write a new Lincoln Rhyme novel when so many of your readers associate Lincoln with Denzel?
Yeah, it really isn't very hard at all. I have a disconnect, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I guess a better word would be I can compartmentalize books and movies pretty easily. And I have been writing novels now full-time for about 25 years, and actually started longer ago than that. And, you know, I know the procedure. I go into a dark room. I have my outline of the book I've done in front of me, close my eyes or let my mind wander a little bit, and I visualize the scene and the characters in my mind, and it comes very easily to me. I have a very vivid visual imagination, and whatever the movie version has been doesn't really exist for me. It's all about the characters that I've created, in the same way that when I did Carte Blanche, the James Bond novel I wrote about 2 years ago, I did not refer to any of the movies in my mind when I was writing the book because, you know, there were so many different James Bonds like Roger Moore, George Lazenby, Sean Connery, of course, and Daniel Craig. That would be kind of conflicting. So I stuck with my own image of James Bond, and it was kind of a connection between me and my own imagination as opposed to the director's imagination of the film.
Okay, The Kill Room has as its center covert government-sanctioned assassinations. What made you write about this right now?
I was generally interested in writing a political thriller. And I had no idea in mind. This goes back about a year and a half or so, simply because I'd never done it. I have written about serial killers and terrorist activities and, you know, kind of private eye sorts of novels as well. But I'd never written about a government action of any kind. And around that time, there was a drone strike in Yemen ordered by the government, the U.S. government, that killed an American citizen. His name was Anwar al-Awlaki, and he was from actually Northern Virginia, but had moved over there to become an internet advocate for terrorist activity. And the government found he was quite dangerous and took him out with a drone strike. And that just raised in my mind the question, wouldn't it have been maybe better to go arrest him and then bring him back and question him? And I wasn't sure whether it was or not. But it raised a question in my mind, and I thought, well, I think that's going to be my political novel. And in The Kill Room, which is very simply this plot, the government does kill an American citizen. He's a little closer to home, though. He's not in the desert reaches of Yemen. He's in the Bahamas on vacation. And so he's killed, but it turns out maybe he's not a terrorist. He wasn't planning a terrorist act. He was planning a peaceful protest. Oh, they got the intelligence wrong. And an idealistic young prosecutor in New York City thinks, well, I'm not going to let the government get away with this. And she tries to prosecute the head of the government agency, along with the man who pulled the trigger, the soldier who pulled the trigger, on grounds that they've acted outside the scope of their authority. And the book becomes a cat and mouse chase as Lincoln Rhyme and Amelia try to put together the case against these fellows, and at the same time they, the two supposed villains, I don't want this to happen. So they try to stop the case, and there are other people too who try to stop the case. And then at the final end of the book, we realize that not all is as it seems to be, which is typical of a Jeffrey Deaver novel.
How much research do you do for all the gadgetry?
Oh, you have to do a lot of research, and it's so much fun. Like you, you're a journalist, of course. I was a journalist some years ago, and part of the fun of working on a story or working on a novel is doing the research. And I've learned that people love the technical side of whatever your topic is, whether it's medicine, if you're writing a medical thriller, or my James Bond novel, which I wrote a few years ago, for instance, all the tricks of tricks of the trade when it comes to spycraft. People just love reading about that. And in the Kill Room, typically I did a lot of research into forensics and into medical science as well, because Lincoln has his quadriplegic condition that he's trying to improve. And then, of course, government intrigue and government espionage required me to do a fair amount of research, you know, up to the point where people don't talk to you anymore, because there are certain things that are top secret, of course. But there's a lot of information out there. The thing to remember about research, though, is that it's easy to put too much in. And you want to make sure that whatever you add, those little factoids, that they further the story. They enhance the story. They don't detract from it or digress. And I hope I hit that balance in The Kill Room.
Oh, I think you did. So do you have an insider in a governmental agency who might have offered you some tips?
I have friends in national intelligence, and they have been very helpful. Of course, they can only tell you things that are public knowledge on public record, which is quite a bit. Of course, I've been involved in writing about various security services and the police and so on for many years, and I know for a fact that the CIA, for instance, gets most of its information from newspapers and radios and TV. They certainly have some covert activity, but most of it is analysis of what they read in, say, the Damascus newspapers or the Moscow Daily Times, if that is a newspaper. Probably isn't. But they get that information, and then they use their skills at analysis to figure out whether this is information that could be helpful to the State Department or the Army and so on. And So it's, you know, there's certainly a lot of covert activity going on out there, but much of the information is public, and I found more than enough material to write a credible book. And of course, these are novels that I write. It is fiction. It has to be believable, and yet it does not have to be 100% accurate in the sense that somebody is going to, you know, base it, their actual job on the things that I write in the book.
Right. I want to talk about Jacob Swan. He is one twisted guy. He's your gourmet assassin who tortures and kills victims with the same knife that he cooks with. What was your inspiration for him?
I have no idea, Elaine. Sometimes an idea just occurs to you from out of the blue. I can say that I grew up in the Midwest, and my life circumstances, loving family, love my mother dearly. She was not a gourmet cook. We opened more cans before dinner than we did actually put together a traditional cooked meal. Well, she heated up what was in the cans, let's put it that way. But I learned at a pretty young age that there was more food than came in a frozen Swanson dinner. And I started cooking at a young age because I just liked to eat, and I learned it wasn't really that difficult to put together a good meal. Well, I've written now 30-some-odd novels and never put food in a book, and I thought, well, it's time to do that. And so rather than do the what I consider a bit of a cliche, have the hero whip up an omelet, I decided to make the villain a gourmand, and then take it one step further and have him use the techniques he learned in cooking in his other job, his professional job, which is that of hitman and interrogator. Because when you think about it, aren't the implements of cooking pretty similar to the implements of torture? You've got your fire, you've got your oven, you've got your sharp implements, you've got skewers, the hammers that I use to pound meat thin to make tenderloins and things. And so I thought, well, that'll be kind of a fun thing to do. And so I created 14 recipes of my own that I put in, that I refer to in the book, and I put the recipes themselves on my website because I didn't want to spend the time in the book. They're kind of lengthy. So your listeners who are interested can go to my website, jeffreydeaver.com, and look up the recipes and make the same things that my nefarious hitman does.
I have to say, he's one of the most original bad guys I've read in years. So congratulations on him.
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me.
You've mentioned The Kill Room is book one of a political trilogy. So when can we expect book two?
Yes, that will be next year. We're going to have another Lincoln Rhyme novel. That will not be the political one. The year after that will be a Catherine Dance novel, my other character, a series character. That will be a political novel number two. And then 2 years after that will be a standalone political novel number three.
All right. Well, we'll just have to wait for it with bated breath. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jeffrey. The book Kill Room was fabulous.
Elaine, thank you so much. A real pleasure.
All righty. Bye. And now, let's listen to The Kill Room, narrated by an ensemble cast.
You live in Argentina, Moreno said to the journalist, who was a slight man, balding and dressed in a tieless blue shirt and threadbare black suit. Buenos Aires?
That's right.
Do you know about the name of the city?
De la Rúa said no. He wasn't a native.
The meaning is good air, of course, Moreno said. He read extensively, several books a week, much of it Latin American literature and history. But the air referred to was in Sardinia, Italy, not Argentina. So called after a settlement on top of a hill in Cagliari. The settlement was above the, let us say, pungent smells of the old city and was accordingly named Buen Aire. The Spanish explorer who discovered what became Buenos Aires named it after that settlement. Of course, that was the first settlement of the city. They were wiped out by the natives, who didn't enjoy the exploitation by Europe.
De la Rúa said, "Even your anecdotes have a decidedly anti-colonial flavor." Moreno laughed, but the humor vanished, and he looked quickly out the window again. That damn glint of light. Still, though, he could see nothing but trees and plants in the garden and that hazy line of land a mile away. The inn was on the largely deserted southwest coast of New Providence, the island in the Bahamas where Nassau was located. The grounds were fenced and guarded, and the garden was reserved for this suite alone and protected by a high fence to the north and south, with the beach to the west. No one was there. No one could be there. A bird, perhaps. A flutter of leaf. Simone had checked the grounds not long ago. Moreno glanced at him now, a large, quiet Brazilian, dark-complected, wearing a nice suit. Moreno's guard dressed better than he did, though not flashy. Simone, in his 30s, looked appropriately dangerous, as one would expect and want in this profession, but he wasn't a thug. He'd been an officer in the army before going civilian as a security expert. He was also very good at his job. Simone's head swiveled. He'd become aware of his boss's gaze and immediately stepped to the window, looking out.
"Just a flash of light," Moreno explained.
The bodyguard suggested drawing the shades.
"I think not."
Moreno had decided that Eduardo de la Rua, who'd flown here coach class at his own expense from the city of Good Air, deserved to enjoy the beautiful view. He wouldn't get to experience much luxury as a hard-working journalist known for reporting the truth rather than producing puff pieces for corporate officials and politicians. Moreno also decided to take the man to a very nice meal at the South Cove Inn's fine restaurant for lunch. Simone gazed outside once more, returned to his chair, and picked up a magazine. De La Rua clicked on the tape recorder.
"Now may I?"
"Please."
Moreno turned his full attention to the journalist.
"Mr. Moreno, your local empowerment movement has just opened an office in Argentina, the first in the country. Could you tell me how you conceived the idea, and what your group does?"
Moreno had given this lecture dozens of times. It varied based on the particular journalist or audience, but the core was simple: to encourage indigenous people to reject U.S. government and corporate influence by becoming self-sufficient, notably through micro-lending, micro-agriculture, and micro-business.
That was The Kill Room by Jeffrey Deaver. Report believes you don't have to be from Boston to love this title. If you've ever spent time at a ballpark, you'll be entertained from the first inning. Make that the first page. Famed manager Terry Francona has written a lively, unvarnished narrative of his tenure with the Boston Red Sox. Francona, The Red Sox Years, was written with Dan Shaughnessy. From 2004 to 2011, Terry Francona managed the Sox. He takes listeners inside the rarefied world of a 21st century clubhouse. From 2004, when they won their first championship in 86 years, through another win in 2007, to the controversial September collapse 4 years later. He recounts the tightrope walk of managing personalities like Pedro Martinez and Manny Ramirez, working with Theo Epstein and his statistics-driven executives, balancing their data with the emotions of a 25-man roster, and meeting the expectations of three owners with wildly differing opinions. Jeff Gerner narrates.
They were exhausted. Empty. 6 weeks of spring training had given way to 6 months of regular season and another 3 weeks of thrill-to-the-marrow playoff excitement and pressure. It was autumn 2004, and the late, late nights had blended into fuzzy mornings with folks asking, "Did that really just happen?" Those four wins against the Yankees, the comeback trick that nobody'd turned in more than a century of postseason baseball, were played on four consecutive days, an aggregate 18 hours and 12 minutes over 44 intense innings. That's an average of more than 4.5 hours per game. Games 4 and 5 at Fenway were actually won on the same calendar day, October 18th, because Game 4 stretched past midnight and Game 5 started fewer than 16 hours later. It was something like a morning-night doubleheader. The World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals was a blur. It was a little bit anticlimactic, if you can say such a thing about the first World Series title in 86 years for a city starving for a baseball championship. At the end, the Red Sox were an army of steamrollers. The World Series games were not nearly as exciting as those in the epic playoff against the Yankees. Despite all the bad things that happened to the franchise after Babe Ruth was sold in 1920, there was a sense of inevitability about the Red Sox march to the finish line after they beat the Yankees in the 2004 American League Championship Series. Major League Baseball's 100th World Series was tension-free, nothing like those fall classics of 1946, 67, 75, or 86, all of which ended with the Sox losing a seventh game. The carpet in the visitors' clubhouse at Busch Stadium was still champagne soggy when the tired, triumphant 2004 Red Sox gathered in their own ancient locker room at Fenway for the parade. The 04 Red Sox were enjoying their first days of folk hero status in New England. All the stuff that everyone had been saying turned out to be true. These guys would never have to buy another beer in Boston. Kevin Millar was going to be able to live off the moment for the rest of his life. Dave Roberts was going to get asked about that stolen base every day until he was 90 years old. David Ortiz was the Dominican Yaz, Manny Ramirez was World Series MVP, and free spirit Orlando Cabrera would be forever worshipped as the guy who replaced the legendary Nomar Garcia Parra. Lanky goofball Derek Lowe was done pitching for the Red Sox, but he was also destined to be a trivia answer as the man who got the win in the clinching game of every round of the playoffs. Boston Mayor Tom Menino and the Red Sox brass plotted the parade meticulously, embracing the concept of a rolling rally, which would maximize fans' exposure to the hub's new heroes. Red Sox players, staff, and their families would ride in duck boats up Boylston Street, then double back down the Charles River. Fans were expected to line the route. Sox CEO Larry Lucchino grew impatient, wanting the day to unfold without a hitch. But then, no one could find the sweatshirts. And that's where our story starts.
That was Francona by Terry Francona and Don Shaughnessy. Mohsin Hamid's How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia is not what you think. It's not a self-help business book. Rather, it's a boldly imagined tale of a poor boy's quest for wealth and love. His novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, established Hamid as a radically inventive storyteller. At the center of this new work is an impoverished rural boy who rises to corporate tycoon in Rising Asia. It follows its nameless hero to the sprawling metropolis where he begins to amass an empire built on an increasingly scarce resource, water. Yet his heart remains set on something else, on the pretty girl whose star rises along with his. Their paths crossing and recrossing, a lifelong affair sparked and snuffed and sparked again. The author narrates.
He gets up and walks outside. Your eyes follow him, his leather sandals unslung at the rear, their straps flapping free, his chapped heels calloused, hard, crustacean-like. He steps through the doorway into the open-air courtyard, located at the center of your extended family's compound. He is unlikely to linger there in contemplation of the single, shade-giving tree, comforting in summer, but now, in spring, still tough and scraggly. Possibly he exits the compound and makes his way to the ridge behind which he prefers to defecate, squatting low and squeezing forcefully to expel the contents of his colon. Possibly he is alone, or possibly he is not. Beside the ridge is a meaty gully as deep as a man is tall, and at the bottom of that gully is a slender trickle of water. In this season, the two are incongruous, the skeletal inmate of a concentration camp dressed in the tunic of an obese pastry chef. Only briefly, during the monsoon, does the gully fill to anything near capacity, and that too is an occurrence less regular than in the past, dependent on increasingly fickle atmospheric currents. The people of your village relieve themselves downstream of where they wash their clothes, a place in turn downstream of where they drink. Further upstream, the village before yours does the same. Farther still, where the water emerges from the hills as a sometimes gushing brook, it is partly employed in the industrial processes of an old, rusting and subscale textile plant, and partly used as drainage for the fart-smelling gray effluent that results. Your father is a cook, but despite being reasonably good at his job and originating in the countryside, he is not a man obsessed with the freshness or quality of his ingredients. Cooking for him is a craft of spice and oil. His food burns the tongue and clogs the arteries. When he looks around him here, he does not see prickly leaves and hairy little berries for an effervescent salad, tan stalks of wheat for a heavenly balloon of stone-ground, stovetop-baked flatbread. He sees instead units of back-breaking toil. He sees hours and days and weeks and years. He sees the labor by which a farmer exchanges his allocation of time in this world for an allocation of time in this world. Here, in the heady bouquet of nature's pantry, your father sniffs mortality. Most of the men of the village who now work in the city do return for the wheat harvest, but it is still too early in the year for that. Your father is here on leave. Nonetheless, he likely accompanies his brothers to spend his morning cutting grass and clover for fodder. He will squat, again, but this time sickle in hand, and his movements of gather, cut, release, waddle will be repeated over and over and over as the sun, too, retraces its own incremental path in the sky. Beside him, a single dirt road passes through the fields. Should the landlord or his sons drive by in their SUV, your father and his brothers will bring their hands to their foreheads, bend low, and avert their eyes. Meeting the gaze of a landlord has been a risky business in these parts for centuries, perhaps since the beginning of history. Recently, some men have begun to do it. But they have beards and earn their keep in the seminaries. They walk tall, with chests out. Your father is not one of them. In fact, he dislikes them almost as much as he does the landlords, and for the same reasons. They strike him as domineering and lazy.
We've just heard How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia by Mohsin Hamid. Readers, this book is on the Times nonfiction bestseller list now, and it's one close to my heart. Susan Spencer Wendell's Until I Say Goodbye, My Year of Living with Joy, is an inspirational memoir by a woman who makes the most of her final days after discovering she has ALS. My beloved sister Linda passed this year from this horrible disease. After Susan Spencer Wendell, a celebrated journalist at the Palm Beach Post, learns of her ALS diagnosis, commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease, she embarks on a series of adventures, traveling to several countries and sharing experiences with loved ones. One such trip takes Susan and her 14-year-old daughter to a bridal shop in New York to search for her daughter's future wedding dress, an occasion Susan knows she'll never see. Co-written with Brett Witter, Until I Say Goodbye is Susan's account of living a full life with humor, courage, and love, but also accepting death with dignity. It's a celebration of life, a look into the face of death, and the effort we must make to show people we love how much they mean to us. Karen White narrates.
My son Wesley wanted to swim with the dolphins. He was turning 9 on the 9th day of the 9th month, September 9th, 2012, and this was his special request. I had promised each of my 3 children a trip during the summer, each to a destination of their choice, a time for togetherness, a time to plant memories to blossom in their futures, a present for them and me. In July, I traveled to New York City with Marina, my teenage daughter. In August, our family spent a week on Sanibel Island, off the west coast of Florida, at the request of my 11-year-old son, Aubrey. The trips were part of a larger plan, a year I dedicated to living with joy, a year in which I took 7 journeys with 7 people central in my life, to the Yukon, Hungary, the Bahamas, Cyprus. A year also of journeys inward, making scrapbooks from a lifetime of photographs, writing, creating a haven in my own backyard, a chicky hut with open sides, a palm-frond roof, and comfy chairs where I summoned memories and friends. Journeys I found more perfect in their doing than I had in their dreaming. Wesley's trip was the simplest and the last. A 3-hour drive in our minivan from our home in South Florida to Discovery Cove in Orlando. "What a beautiful drive," my sister Stephanie commented, cheerful as ever, as we passed through the swampy monotony of Central Florida. Discovery Cove featured a huge artificial lagoon. A beach ringed one side, with rocks on the others. Palm trees rose above the lush landscape. Their fronds looked to me like fireworks heralding the occasion there. We gathered on the beach in a drizzle, watching fins slice through the play area on the other side of the lagoon. "Which one is ours?" Wesley asked. "Which one is ours?" A trainer led us into the water. Suddenly a creature appeared before us, a smooth gray face with shining black eyes, a long mouth with edges turned upward as if in a smile. Her bottle nose bobbed, signaling, "I want to play." Wesley was over the moon. He jabbered and jumped, too excited to stand still. With his long blonde hair, wetsuit, and blue eyes, he looked like the surfer boys I so admired in my youth. Happy birthday, my son.
That was Until I Say Goodbye by Susan Spencer Wendell with Brett Witter. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Barry is a New York Times best-selling author with 15 million books in print. Barry has a passion for history, which he explores in his popular Cotton Malone adventures. He and his wife have created the History Matters Foundation, dedicated to historic preservation. Through lectures, galas, and writers' workshops, Steve crisscrosses the country to raise funds and awareness to save endangered historic treasures. Last year, the American Library Association named Steve their first spokesman for National Preservation Week. Today, we'll speak with Steve about his newest title, The King's Deception. Welcome, Steve. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Great to be back.
The King's Deception has a secret at its core that could rock England's monarchy. Give our listeners an overview.
Well, I have to be careful here because I don't want to give away something really cool in the book, because it is really something very interesting. Elizabeth and I were in a little village north of London a few years ago doing some publicity work for the British publisher, and a lady there started telling me about this local legend. It was a legend that dealt with the Tudors and with Elizabeth I, and it had been around 400 years. And as I began to research the legend, I began to realize that there was more truth to it than I first thought. And as I looked into it more and more, it became clear that not only the legend may be not a legend, but it could actually be true. So I fashioned the novel, The King's Deception, all around that. I wish I could tell you what it was, but it would give away the whole book, and I don't want to spoil it for the readers. I can only tell you that it's very shocking, it's very surprising, but it's also very logical, and it makes a lot of sense, too.
Okay, well, I've read the book, and I loved it, and I know this little town is called the town of Bisley. And so the parade that you talk about, which I won't give it away either, it actually happens. Is that correct?
Yes, that parade happens each year. They do it, there's a peculiar little twist that happens in that parade, and it got a lot of people wondering, why does that happen? Why does that occur? What is it? What's going on there? And so that's why it got my interest up, and it ended up becoming the novel.
All right. For those of us readers who haven't met him yet, introduce us to Cotton Malone.
He's a retired Justice Department agent. He lives in Copenhagen now. He owns an old bookshop there. And he gets himself into trouble all the time. He just can't seem to stay out of his former profession. And in this particular adventure, it deals with his son, Gary, his 16-year-old son. He has a very interesting relationship with Gary. There's some unresolved issues there with Gary, and these are all going to get resolved in the King's Deception. So it's really a father-son story as much as it is action, history, secrets, conspiracy, and international set.
Okay, speaking of father and son, I know that William Cecil and his son Robert Cecil are very important characters in this book. Talk a little about them.
The Cecils were the brains behind the later Tudor monarchs. William Cecil himself was Elizabeth's Secretary of State, which we would call today the Prime Minister, her chief aide, basically. He was the brains behind it all. He made it all happen. He was the reason why she could rule so effectively. He was an excellent, excellent administrator and a very clever and skilled statesman. When he died in the late 16th century, his son took over, and his son assured the switch from Elizabeth I to James I. He kept everything running smoothly. These were very skilled men who knew what they were doing, and they formed the heart of this story because they're at the center of the secret that centers around Elizabeth I, and these two are vital to that. And it was interesting to learn about them. I mean, Robert was particularly interesting. He was kind of deformed. He had a hunched back. He was not a very attractive man, yet he was this great statesman and great ladies' man and great everything. But he ultimately crashed and burned. He actually ultimately lost all power before he died.
Hmm. You write about Henry Fitzroy, who was the illegitimate firstborn son of Henry VIII. He was an actual historical figure, is that right?
That is correct. Henry had an illegitimate son while he was married to Catherine of Aragon, his first wife, and that's what got him so angry at Catherine. Catherine kept miscarrying, and then she had a daughter that she gave birth to that became Mary. She could not give birth to a son, yet he gave birth to a son with his mistress. And so it convinced him that there was nothing wrong with him, that he was not the problem. The problem was his wife, and that's one reason why he got intent on getting rid of her. Fitzroy is a term that is used and given to the illegitimate children of a monarch. They get the last name of Fitzroy. So if you ever see that in a history book, you know what's going on there. And he loved Henry Fitzroy. He was, in fact, if he had not had, ultimately had a male son, or even worse, Henry died at a very young age. If Henry had survived past 16 and Henry VIII had not had his own son, some say that we might have had Henry IX in Henry Fitzroy.
Mm.
Even though he was illegitimate, Henry was laying the groundwork with that in Parliament. But ultimately, Henry Fitzroy died at the age of 16. But that still figures into this story very prominently because Henry Fitzroy has a lot to do with the secret involving the Tudors.
Right. Now, you talk about Bram Stoker's book of famous imposters. Talk about that for a bit.
That is the very first written account of what we call the Bisley Boy legend, which forms, you know, the basis of this story. And the Bisley Boy legend was first detailed in Bram Stoker's book. And Stoker published that book in 1910. He stumbled across the legend just like I stumbled across the legend. I didn't know he had done that till after I learned about it and I found out about Stoker's book. So there's an excerpt of Stoker's book included in the novel to show you just how on point he was.
Hmm. Elizabeth died when she was 70, yet she was buried with her half-sister Mary. How many years had separated their deaths?
About 45, maybe. Elizabeth reigned, I believe, 45 years, so there was quite a while. Mary had been in the grave a long time when they put Elizabeth in there with her. Extremely unusual to bury two queens in the same tomb, and it all also figures into the legend and figures into the great secret that we're dealing with in here, that is actually true, that these two women were buried together.
Elizabeth was such a towering figure. How was she not laid to rest in her own tomb?
Well, that's an excellent question. Robert Cecil survived Elizabeth, and Robert Cecil was in charge of her burial. And he chose to bury Elizabeth and Mary together. Now, in actual history, we have no explanation for that. There is no explanation for that given anywhere. But when you start studying the legend and the secret that I'm dealing with in this book, then it begins to make perfect sense why Robert Cecil did that and why he decided to intermix and mingle their bones together. It makes perfect sense, but in actual reality, we don't have an explanation.
How much time did you spend researching this story before you began writing?
Well, 6 months of preliminary research before I start writing. I do that with any novel. And then it was 12 months of additional research while I was writing. So it was an 18-month process from start to finish.
Tell our readers about your insider information about Elizabeth's portraits and how she didn't allow herself to age in them.
Yes, in history notes her as a very vain person, and that she was very careful about her appearance. Now, there's some other explanations as to why that may have occurred that we explore in the novel, but finally in the 1590, a decree was issued that it would be called the Mask of Youth, and from this point forward, her face would appear like this, and they fashioned a face. And if you will look at the portraits of Elizabeth from around 1570 forward to about to the time of her death in 1603, you will see that the face of Elizabeth is pretty much identical in every one of them, even though she's a very elderly woman in most of those. The portrait that really figures into the novel, the rainbow portrait, if you'll look at that, she looks like a woman of about 30 or 40 in there, but in actuality she was 70 years old when that was painted. She was actually dead when it was finished. So she decreed that she would be forever young. So we really have no idea what Elizabeth actually looks like. And there are only a handful of drawings of what she looked like prior to the age of 35.
Well, this is a story about a very complex mystery, and I just loved it. What's your next project?
Cotton Malone, another Cotton Malone adventure. He'll be coming back to America for a very interesting story that's going to deal with Abraham Lincoln.
All right. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to that. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today. This is a really great read.
I appreciate it so much. I hope everyone enjoys it.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now, let's listen to a sample of The King's Deception, narrated by Scott Brick.
Cotton Malone stepped up to the customs window at Heathrow Airport and presented two passports, his own and his son Gary's. Positioned between himself and the glass-enclosed counter, however, stood a problem. 15-year-old Ian Dunn. "This one doesn't have a passport," he told the attendant, then explained who he was and what he was doing. A brief call to somebody led to verbal approval for Ian to re-enter the country, which didn't surprise Malone. He assumed that since the Central Intelligence Agency wanted the boy in England, they'd make the necessary arrangements. He was tired from the long flight, though he'd caught a few hours of sleep. His knee still hurt from the kick Ian had delivered in Atlanta before trying to flee from that airport. Luckily, his own 15-year-old Gary had been quick to tackle the pesky Scot before he'd escaped the concourse. Favors for friends. Always a problem. This one for his former boss, Stephanie Nell, at the Magellan Billet. "It's the CIA," she'd told him. Langley had called directly. Somehow they were aware Malone was in Georgia and wanted him to escort the boy back to London, handing him over to the Metropolitan Police. After that, he and Gary could head on to Copenhagen. In return, they'd received first-class tickets all the way home to Denmark. Not bad. His own were coach. 4 days ago, he'd flown to Georgia for two reasons. The State Bar of Georgia required 12 hours of continuing legal education from all of its licensed lawyers. Though he'd retired from the Navy and the Magellan Billet, he still kept his law license active, which meant he had to satisfy the annual education mandate. Last year, he'd attended a sanctioned event in Brussels, a 3-day meeting on multinational property rights. This year, he'd chosen a seminar in Atlanta on international law. Not the most exciting way to spend 2 days, but he'd worked too hard for that degree to simply allow his ticket to lapse. The second reason was personal. Gary had asked to spend the Thanksgiving holiday with him. School was out, and his ex-wife Pam thought an overseas trip a good idea. He'd wondered why she was so reticent, and found out last week when Pam called his bookshop in Copenhagen. "Gary's angry," she said. "He's asking a lot of questions."
"Ones you don't want to answer?"
"Ones I'm going to have a tough time answering."
Which was an understatement.
6 months ago, she'd revealed a harsh truth to him during another call from Atlanta to Denmark. Gary was not his natural son. Instead, the boy was the product of an affair some 16 years past. Now she'd told Gary that truth, and his son was not happy. For Malone, the news had been crushing. He could only imagine what it had been for Gary. "Neither one of us was a saint back then, Cotton." She liked to remind him of that reality, as if somehow he'd forgotten that their marriage supposedly ended because of his lapses. "Gary wants to know about his birth father."
"So do I."
She'd told him nothing about the man and refused his requests for information. "He has no involvement here," she said. "He's a total stranger to all of us. Just like the women you were with have nothing to do with this. I don't want to open that door, ever."
We've just heard The King's Deception by Steve Barry. John le Carré is out with a new novel, and The Book Report is pleased to preview it. A Delicate Truth opens in 2008. A counter-terrorist operation, codenamed Wildlife, is being mounted on the British Crown colony of Gibraltar. Its purpose? To capture and abduct a key jihadist arms buyer. An ambitious foreign office minister, a private defense contractor, and a shady American CIA operative of the evangelical far right. Fast forward to Cornwall in 2011. A disgraced Special Forces soldier delivers a message from the dead. Was Operation Wildlife the success it was cracked up to be? Or a human tragedy that has been ruthlessly covered up? The author performs the book.
A radiant crimson counterpane of imitation silk lay over it, and on the counterpane an innocent-looking cell phone, which he had been assured was modified to the highest state of encryption. And though he was of little faith in such matters, he could only suppose it was. Each time he passed it, his gaze fixed on it with a mixture of reproach, longing, and frustration.
"I regret to inform you, Paul, that you will be totally incommunicado, save for operational purposes throughout your mission."
The laborious South African voice of Elliot, his self-designated field commander, is warning him.
"Should an unfortunate crisis afflict your fine family during your absence, they will pass their concerns to your office's welfare department, whereupon contact with you will be made. Do I make myself clear, Paul?"
"You do, Elliot. Little by little, you do." Reaching the overlarge picture window at the further end of the room, he scowled upward through the grimy net curtains at Gibraltar's legendary rock, which, sallow, wrinkled, and remote, scowled back at him like an angry dowager. Yet again, out of habit and impatience, he examined his alien wristwatch and compared it with the green numerals on the radio clock beside the bed. The watch was of scratched steel with a black dial, a replacement for the gold Cartier presented to him on that 25th by his beloved wife, on the strength of an inheritance from one of her many deceased aunts. Oh, but hang on a minute. Paul hasn't got a bloody wife. Paul Anderson has no wife, no daughter. Paul Anderson's a bloody hermit.
"Can't have you wearing that, Paul, darling, can we now?"
a motherly woman his own age is saying to him a lifetime ago in the red-brick suburban villa near Heathrow Airport, where she and her sisterly colleague are dressing him for the part.
"Not with those nice initials engraved on it, can we? You'd have to say you'd nicked it off of somebody married, wouldn't you, Paul?"
Sharing the joke, determined as ever to be a good chap by his own lights, he looks on while she writes Paul on an adhesive label and locks his gold watch away in a cash box with his wedding ring for what she calls the duration. How in God's name did I ever get to end up in this hellhole in the first place? Did I jump, or was I pushed, or was it a bit of both? Describe, please, in a few well-chosen circuits of the room, the precise circumstances of your unlikely journey from blessed monotony to solitary confinement on a British colonial rock.
So how's your poor dear wife?
Asks the not-quite-superannuated Ice Queen of Personnel Department, now grandly rechristened Human Resources for no reason known to man, having summoned him without a word of explanation to her lofty bower on a Friday evening when all good citizens are hurrying home. The two are old adversaries. If they have anything at all in common, it is the feeling that there are so few of them left.
That was A Delicate Truth by John le Carré. Orphan Master's Son, a novel of North Korea, has won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. An epic tale, the book follows a young man's journey through the icy waters, dark tunnels, and eerie spy chambers of the world's most mysterious dictatorship, North Korea. Park Jeon-do is the haunted son of a lost mother and an influential father who runs Long Tomorrows, a work camp for orphans. There, the boy is given his first taste of power, selecting which orphans eat first and which will be lent out for manual labor. Recognized for his loyalty and instincts, Jeon-do comes to the attention of superiors in the state, rises in the ranks, and starts on a road from which there will be no return. Considering himself a humble citizen of the greatest nation in the world, Jeon-do becomes a professional kidnapper who must navigate the shifting roles, violence, and baffling demands of his Korean overlords to stay alive. Driven to the limit of a man's endurance, he boldly takes on Kim Jong-tu in an attempt to save the woman he loves. Part thriller, part tale of innocence lost, part romance, The Orphan Master's Son is also a riveting portrait of a world hidden from view, North Korea. An ensemble cast narrates.
Jeon-do's mother was a singer. That was all Jeon-do's father, the orphan master, would say about her. The orphan master kept a photograph of a woman in his small room at Long Tomorrow's. She was quite lovely. Eyes large and sideways looking, lips pursed with an unspoken word. Since beautiful women in the provinces get shipped to Pyongyang, that's certainly what had happened to his mother. The real proof of this was the orphan master himself. At night, he'd drink, and from the barracks, the orphans would hear him weeping and lamenting, striking half-heard bargains with the woman in the photograph. Only Jeon-do was allowed to comfort him, to finally take the bottle from his hands. As the oldest boy at Long Tomorrow's, Jeon-do had responsibilities, portioning the food, assigning bunks, renaming the new boys from the list of the 114 Grand Martyrs of the Revolution. Even so, the orphan master was serious about showing no favoritism to his son, the only boy at Long Tomorrow's who wasn't an orphan. When the rabbit warren was dirty, it was Jeon-do who spent the night locked in it. When boys wet their bunks, it was Jeon-do who chipped the frozen piss off the floor. Jeon-do didn't brag to the other boys that he was the son of the orphan master, rather than some kid dropped off by parents on their way to a 927 camp. If someone wanted to figure it out, it was pretty obvious. Jeon-do had been there before all of them, and the reason he'd never been adopted was because his father would never let someone take his only son. And it made sense that after his mother was stolen to Pyongyang, his father had applied for the one position that would allow him to both earn a living and watch over his son. The surest evidence that the woman in the photo was Jeon-do's mother was the unrelenting way the orphan master singled him out for punishment. It could only mean that in Jeon-do's face, the orphan master saw the woman in the picture, a daily reminder of the eternal hurt he felt from losing her. Only a father in that kind of pain could take a boy's shoes in winter.
That was The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson. Readers, we've covered the spectrum this week, from fiction prize winners to nonfiction bestsellers. I hope these samplings are your guide to what you'd like to take along on your summer travels. FYI, to get titles from Beach Read's first episode, go to bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of May 25th. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you back here next week on The Book Report.